We continue in our study on romanticizing life, and my topic this evening is time. It's hard for us creatures of time to define time or contemplate it in relation to God's eternity. What is time? A qualified accurate definition that I've heard before said that it is the condition under which creation experiences time. The condition under which creation experiences time. Therefore, trying to separate it from bringing God into that picture, how God experiences time. It's very complicated when you get into eternity and time and God's eternity and His working in time. Those concepts are extremely difficult to understand. Most pagan views of history or time show to be a recurring cycles. I can remember when I was a very new believer in our church, there was a history teacher. I believe it was a high school history teacher. And one evening sitting down with me and showing me how history works and going through these cycles and, you know, showing me how it always comes back to the same place again. I was just bowled over saying, wow, this is incredible. But completely misunderstanding how God works through time and in history. Because God's revelation shows a beginning of time and history that is moving toward His predestined goal. And it shows time and history to be linear. Had a beginning, and it's moving in this line toward an end where the culmination which God has predestined, as opposed to little circles where they just keep repeating themselves and a few details get changed, but ultimately you're caught in this forever revolving, repetitious thing. Without revelation, we wouldn't know this, and we put aside revelation on this matter to our own peril. Carl F. Henry said that time is one of the most vexing problems of philosophy. And if you see how the philosophers have approached this to try and explain it, to try and make sense of it, you'll quickly agree with Henry. It is difficult for us to contemplate eternity in relationship to time. We probably need to use time in different ways when we are talking about such things, because we know that God's creation is not eternal. What He created is not eternal. So in our own minds, we're trying to talk about that. We've got to say, okay, yes, but then there was a time in God's experience before creation. So it's very difficult. So maybe it's been suggested we just need to keep that distinction. There's different ways to use time, because it's very hard for us as creatures of time to project, well, was there a time when God didn't? Is God in time? Is He, you know, we know He's not. But how to make sense of that, our minds struggle with that. But time is a very important concept, and God's time in history is vital for our understanding. Despite the possible philosophical problems that one can encounter when thinking about these things, if we bow to Scripture and remain within its bounds, and those parameters that it sets on this topic, we can arrive at a true understanding of time, even though we won't have a comprehensive understanding in the sense of answering all our questions. But we need to understand time as it's relative to our own lives and circumstances and what that means. The Bible doesn't regard time as a problem, but rather as a created sphere in which God's redemptive plan is actualized. That's what's happening. That's what time is doing. God's plan is being fulfilled and accomplished. Carl Henry said that outside the flow of biblical theology, virtually the whole movement of ancient religion and philosophy depreciated the significance of temporal order. None of them rose to the biblical emphasis that history displays a purposive movement to an intelligent moral goal. That's where we're going. It's a purposeful movement towards an intelligent moral goal. That's what history is doing. It's moving towards that. To continue with Henry, the non-biblical religions and speculations of antiquity did not escape the cycle theory of history as a series of reoccurring ages. Nowhere does the importance of time come into view as in biblical teaching. While time is not ultimate, it is the divinely created sphere of God's preserving and redemptive work, and the arena of man's decision on his way to eternal destiny. History moves towards a divine goal involving redemption of the elect by the Creator and Lord of the universe. Within this historical matrix, every thought, word, and deed has repercussions in the eternal and moral order. So everything is relevant and has repercussions and significance and import, because it is moving in that order that is God's order. So why did God create time? Why did He create, but why did He create time? Ultimately for His glory. There's no other reason that time came into being, other than that God was wanting to exalt His own glory. And how does time glorify God? Because as it moves from beginning to end, it manifests God's grace, His wisdom, and His power. And you could add in a number of other things if you wanted, but it's manifesting all these things. As we move through time, that's what's being manifested to us, of God's grace, wisdom, and power. As He works out his plan of redemption. Thus the whole flow of history is covenantal and always is moving along in terms of the covenant. That's what history is about, the whole covenantal flow of God's plan. And these terms are revealed to us by God. The covenantal, what does it mean to have a covenantal view of history? It means that there's an ultimate God, the transcendent God, who's over all things. He is sovereign over all things, but he's also very involved and very close to the dealings of our lives. So that's what it is. That's God's plan. Secondly, he's ordained a hierarchical structure, which is really a system of representative authority. So God's in charge, and there's others given authority under him in order to carry out his responsibilities. But each one is a representative authority. Even as the father is in charge, head of the family, he is representing his family before God and from God to his family. He's representing God's authority. And so there's this whole representative structure, whether it's in the state, those who have authority in the state are representing God and are therefore to rule according to his will and manifest God's justice and righteousness. People are represented by those leaders. So there's this hierarchical representative authority structure. The next aspect of this covenantal flow of history is God's law, which governs and directs all our dealings. He shows us what's right and wrong and what's expected of us. So we have his law as well. Fourthly, he judges through his blessings and his curses. Where the law is obeyed and followed, there's great blessing, which advances the whole historical cause. And where there's rebellion, there's also judgment upon that. And finally, he has ordained a long-term future over time for his faithful servants. Their inheritance is a tremendous blessing and a great motivation in their lives. They have this inheritance that lies before them. So every person has been placed at a specific point in history and given a certain amount of time for the purpose of exalting God's name. God is exalted through both his blessings and cursings that come upon people as they either live in submission to or in rebellion against his word. God is exalted through his cursings. Is there a passage that comes to mind? Romans 9, where God tells us why he raised up Pharaoh, so that he might pour out his judgment upon him and so that his name might be glorified throughout the earth. So God's glory is exalted through his judgments and his blessings. This is what we read in Deuteronomy 28, as we read verses 1 and 2 of Deuteronomy 28. Now it shall come to pass, if you diligently obey the voice of the Lord your God, to observe carefully all his commandments which I command you today, that the Lord your God will set you high above all nations of the earth, and all these things shall come upon you and overtake you, because you obey the voice of the Lord your God. And then he goes into giving these incredible blessings. If you obey, this is what I'm going to do. But can you see the purpose, the flow of God working out his purpose in history? It is through this channel here. He's saying, this is what I'm giving you to do, this is how you do it, and this is going to be working out my purpose in history as my ordained plan comes into fruition, into completion. So this is how God's plan moves along through history. His faithful people and nations are prospered so that they can more effectively do his will while at the same time manifesting covenantal faithfulness to those who are unfaithful. That's what Israel was supposed to do, to manifest the wisdom and the blessings of God because of their faithfulness. As Deuteronomy 8 and verse 18 says, and you shall remember the Lord your God, for it is he who gives you power to get wealth, that you may establish his covenant which he swore to your fathers, as it is this day. So God wants to bless us. That's the reason for the blessings in Deuteronomy 28, so that we might glorify him. He gives us power to get wealth so that our wealth can be used in a more effective and efficient way of advancing his kingdom. When God gives a people power to get wealth, it is for this purpose of bearing witness to the reality of his covenantal blessings for obedience. When nations continue floundering in poverty for generations, it is evidence of God's curses in history for their rebellion against him. There's no other explanation for that, biblically speaking, why they are floundering for generation after generation. Why do nations just not seem to pull out of this poverty and blindness? What is it? It's that. It's the curse of God is upon them. Going back to Deuteronomy 28, and those who diligently obey the voice of the Lord, we read, that's from verse 5 and following, the Lord will command the blessing on you, in your storehouses, and in all to which you set your hand. And he will bless you in the land which the Lord your God is giving you. The Lord will establish you as a holy people to himself, just as he has sworn to you. If you keep the commandment of the Lord your God and walk in his ways, then all peoples of the earth shall see that you are called by the name of the Lord, and they shall be afraid of you. Deuteronomy 28 verses 8 through 10, that is. They'll be afraid of you. They'll see the wisdom, and you'll have prosperity and peace. at verse 15 of Deuteronomy 28. So you've got the first 14 verses of God talking about this great blessing that would come on. And then from verse 15 to the end of the chapter, which goes to 67 or 68 verses, he then spells out what is going to happen if there's rebellion against him. It shows God's curses upon the people. It says that from verse 15, "But it shall come to pass, if you do not obey the voice of the Lord your God, to observe carefully all his commandments and his statutes, which I command you today, that all these curses will come upon you and overtake you. Cursed shall you be in the city, cursed shall you be in the country, cursed shall be your basket and your kneading bowl, cursed shall be the fruit of your body and the produce of your land, the increase of your cattle and the offspring of your flocks. Cursed shall you be when you come in, and cursed shall you be when you go out." And later on, verses 43 and 44, you could pull out many different things, but this is one of the other curses. It says, this is what God will do to a nation when he's cursing them. "The alien who is among you shall rise higher and higher above you, and you shall come down lower and lower. He shall lend to you, but you shall not lend to him. He shall be the head, and you shall be the tail." You go into subjection to the alien who is among you. It is a sign of God's cursing upon that nation. And thus, as the second generation was about to enter into the promised land, Moses laid out the basis for their success in that land. In Deuteronomy 4, verses 5 through 8, he says, "Surely I have taught you statutes and judgments, just as the Lord my God commanded me, that you should act according to them in the land which you go to possess. Therefore be careful to observe them, for this is your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of the peoples, who will hear all these statutes and say, 'Surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people. For what great nation is there that has God so near to it as the Lord our God is to us, for whatever reason we may call upon him? And what great nation is there that has such statutes and righteous judgments as are in all this law which I set before you this day? Only take heed to yourself and diligently keep yourself, lest you forget these things your eyes have seen, and lest they depart from your heart all the days of your life." Deuteronomy 4, 5 through 8. You have to ask yourself, if the nation was going to be manifesting to pagans the wisdom of God's justice in national affairs, where is the argument today of those who have an issue with applying these things to our nations? We've got a greater wisdom than this wisdom, which the pagans in that day would have recognized and said, "This is incredible. This is an incredible people that we're witnessing, as we're seeing their civil life and the way they function and the amount of blessings that come upon them." But that's how God advances his cause through history, in time and towards the ultimate goal. His outworking for his people is to bless their faithfulness. That's what he has set it up for, and said, "Okay, this is how it's going to work in time. I'm going to bless your faithfulness," which in turn ought to inspire them to greater works of faithfulness and thus glorify the Lord's name. God works out his will in and through his people. Paul clearly teaches this in Philippians when he's talking about salvation being worked out or manifested. He says in Philippians 2, verses 12 and 13, "Therefore, my beloved, as you have always obeyed, not in my presence only," he has the obedience aspect, doing God's will, "but now much more in my absence, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling, for it is God who works in you both to will and do for his good pleasure." So here God's working out his good pleasure. He's working it out in us and through us, but he's working it out through our obedience in time and in history as we apply his truth to every area of life. That's how we work out our salvation with fear and trembling. That's how we work out the plan that God has ordained on this line of history, moving towards the ultimate goal that he has set up and placed at the end of time where we are going to reach. God works out his plans today in the same way that he worked out his plans through the nation of Israel, as Deuteronomy 4 shows. See, so that Philippians and Deuteronomy 4 are showing the same thing, as God working out his plans, him working through his people and in his people. Obey the law and manifest God's blessing and wisdom to the surrounding nations. That's what it is. Manifest his blessing. That's what we're called to do. Show forth the praises of God, the glory of God. We live our lives and we receive his tremendous blessing upon us, and others look upon them and said, "What makes these people so blessed, so prosperous, so effective in their dealings, so just?" You see, right after God telling the Israelites to diligently keep the law of God in Deuteronomy 4, verses 9 and 10, he says of that chapter, "And teach them to your children and your grandchildren, especially concerning the day you stood before the Lord your God in Horeb, when the Lord said to me, 'Gather the people to me, and I will let them hear my words, that they may learn to fear me all the days that they live on the earth, and that they may teach their children.'" So he lays that forth. This is his historical move. This is the plan that God has ordained in all eternity, and how he manifests it now on earth his whole plan is through this, through his law, through us applying it. But now he emphasizes in those two verses, those last two verses we read, verses 9 and 10 of Deuteronomy 4, he repeats twice the importance of teaching this and passing it on to the next generation. Twice, Moses instructs parents to teach their children the whole of God's law, which shows how vital this is to this long-term plan in history of generational faithfulness and nations receiving covenantal blessings rather than covenantal cursing. This is it. This is how a nation receives the blessings of God. This is how they possess it. This is how they maintain it. This is how they guarantee it. It is through this very basic and simple thing, which takes us all on into eternity as well. But it's focusing on time. This is the responsibility. When we understand the centrality of generational faithfulness to the realization of God's covenant plan, then what Malachi says is to be expected. We're to expect Malachi to end the Old Testament scriptures the way he does, as Malachi 4 verses 4 through 6. He says to the nation, "Remember the law of Moses, my servant, which I commanded him in Horeb for all Israel, with the statutes and the judgments. Behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Lord, and he will turn the hearts of the fathers to the children and the hearts of the children to their fathers, lest I come and strike the earth with a curse." Malachi talking about the law that he commanded Moses in Horeb immediately should take us back to Deuteronomy 4. So, okay, what's the context here? What's the context for understanding Malachi? What is Malachi actually talking about? And it should take us back to Deuteronomy 4 verses 9 and 10, where Moses says to the people, "I want you to teach your children and your grandchildren, but especially concerning the day you stood before the Lord your God in Horeb, when he said to you, 'Gather the people to me, and I will let them hear my words, that they may learn to fear me all the days that they live on the earth, and that they may teach their children.'" So that's what was commanded at Horeb. And so Malachi, when he says that, "especially what I commanded Moses as the people stood before me in Horeb," that's what we should be thinking about. And then he goes on to explain that they might turn the hearts of the fathers to the children, hearts of the children to the fathers. Now we understand what Malachi is talking about. Those who argue that Malachi is talking about fathers and sons turning hearts to each other, that is wrong. That is not what Malachi is saying. But rather calling people to turn their hearts to the historical fathers of the nation fail to appreciate the significance of God's covenantal blessing throwing through families for generations. They fail to understand that. And amongst those who fail to understand it is John Calvin. That's what he points you to when he writes on this text. And so you've got many commentators who would stand on Calvin. And so I'm disagreeing with Calvin here because of the context of what is being said, of where Malachi takes this passage from. And when you see the significance of this plan throughout Scripture, you realize indeed this is what Malachi is talking about. This is the emphasis that he places on this text. This is what the fifth commandment teaches, which is the first commandment with promise. And what is that promise? It's a generational promise. It's a community thing of long life in the land. It's not talking to an individual and saying, you know, if you just obey your mother and father, I'm going to give you long life in that sense. Obviously, it includes that. But the whole thrust is this generational impact of living long in the land. What do you live long in the land for? So you can prosper, so that you can advance the kingdom and bring about God's purposes. So that's what the fifth commandment is talking about. That obedient children will live long in the land. This is God's promise for the long-term national prosperity. When a people are characterized by parents instructing their children in the full counsel of God, instructing their children, and the children obeying this instruction, obeying their parents, submitting to that authority, as Moses has commanded the parents must do as they stood in Horeb, command your children, instruct them in these ways. As they are doing that, and children are embracing this command from the Lord, according to the fifth commandment, there we're going to say they will live long in the land. And we understand what that's for. It's not for a self-serving thing, so that I can have this long life to serve myself. People will be firmly established and flourish. They will live long as a nation. That's what really is emphasis, as a people group. When parents fail to instruct, and when children refuse to obey this instruction, God's curse will come upon that people, and their nation will be destroyed. There's no debate about that. Their nation is going to be destroyed. And that's why, I believe, the last word that God leaves in the Old Testament, as Malachi brings the last prophetic word, for 400 years there was going to be silence, as far as we know, because we have no revelation telling us there was any prophetic word brought. But for 400 years, between the last word from Malachi and John the Baptist being announced, so to speak, and coming on the scene, the last word is curse. So the Bible ends, curse. It means utter destruction, actually, the full force of the word that is used there. It's this call and put completely under the ban. And that's how God says, unless the fathers are going to turn the hearts to the children, children to the fathers, I will come and strike the earth with a curse. And then as John the Baptist is announced, who he is, the angel announces that prophet, behold, I send before you Elijah the prophet, who will turn the hearts of the fathers to the children, hearts of the children to the fathers. He announces John the Baptist's ministry. This is what's going to take place. And Christ comes on that. That's the whole purpose of redemption. That's the core, that's the focus, that's the heartbeat of redemption, is that family aspect and this generational faithfulness that flows on throughout time. Covenantal blessing and covenantal cursing. And God reveals to his people how these are brought about, how they are blessed or how they are cursed. History is not a random, inexplicable collection of events. It's covenantal. It's the only way that history unfolds. It's covenantal. The covenant God has his plan, has his purpose, and he is working all things towards that end, glorifying him through the manifestation of his blessings and cursings upon individuals and nations as they embrace or reject his covenant word. There is no other purpose in history. There is no other movement of history other than that. Cursings and blessings. Do away with the law of God, and we do away with the basis for blessing, and do away with the reason for cursing. And so history comes to an end. Time comes to an end. There's no more purpose in time. We don't know where we're going now. Now we're just marking time. We're not going anywhere. We're just kind of staying in the same place and waiting for something to happen. We don't have no purpose. We have no goal. We have no objective. We have no dominion. We have no reason to raise up our children and pour our lives into them and instruct them in these ways, because we don't believe there's any real significance, long-term goal. It doesn't matter whether we do it or we don't. It doesn't matter. And thus you see the church floundering, wandering around. What are we to do? Well, let's refine our worship service. Let's really build these big choirs and build these big activities, because that gives them purpose and meaning, as opposed to what God has truly called us to do. Because God has shown that his glory will be manifested in this way. We have been called to serve the Lord and given some time on this earth to do that, to work toward the goal that the Lord has ordained. And the time that each of us has been given is very limited. But the one who seeks to frustrate God's plans, that's the great enemy of our souls, he seeks to get us to believe that time is a resource that we have in overabundance. That's what he's constantly telling us. We've got an overabundance of time, and there's no kind of constraints on it, so don't feel pressurized about time. There's plenty to go around and more to spare. Job, however, said that his life was like a breath. I just have a breath. He likened his life to a cloud that quickly vanishes. He says, my life flees faster than a runner. It passes like a swift ship. He says, it's like an eagle rushing to its prey. If you've seen a hawk or an eagle diving down, bam, he's got his prey. That's it. Life's gone. It's over. It's like a flower that fades away. It's like a shadow that doesn't continue. It was there for a moment, and now it's gone. There's nothing left of what it was. James says, or he asks, what is your life? It is even a vapor that appears for a little time and then vanishes away. James 4 and verse 14. You see, we don't have much time to accomplish what God has called us to do. And our enemy is vigilant, constantly manufacturing ways to get us to squander the little time that we have. When God's servants are distracted and thus fail to use their time effectively, the kingdom doesn't move forward. A romantic view of time is believing that your time is not running out, that you have an abundance of extra time, and I can always still do effective things at some later date. But vital to us being able to stand against the many, many distractions that fling themselves into our lives is having a biblical understanding of how little of it we have, and how critically important it is for us to use the time we have been given for effective kingdom advancement. To truly commit ourselves to that. Yes, how can I effectively use the time that I've got? We can't do everything we might like to do. And that is why the Christian life, in many aspects, this is one of them, of why it is one of self-sacrifice. Because we ought to be weighing up how best to use the limited resources of time so that we can accomplish the most for the kingdom. And we constantly need to be sacrificing ourselves and have that understanding in our mind. Yes, I don't have that much time to accomplish what I'd like to accomplish. I know Francis Schaeffer, I believe, said he did his best work when he found out he had cancer and his time was now short. He suddenly realized, whoa, my time is very short. And I believe that whole, how shall we then live? I believe that whole series was made while he had cancer. He was dying. And he realized, my time is finished. It's running out. I don't have much left. But up until the time, you know, somehow cancer brings home the reality of the shortness of our life. And unfortunately, many times our minds don't realize how actually short our lives are anyway. until something like that comes upon us. But by God's grace, we should be praying that He imprints upon us the shortness, the brevity of the time we have to make an impact, to influence, to do things that are worthy for the kingdom. We're not to be guided by our feelings, but by our responsibilities. The kingdom of heaven is not about our pleasures and our rights, but about our responsibilities. Our responsibility to be working for the realization of God's goal, while keeping in mind how short our opportunity is to labor for our King. It's a very short time we've been given. It's a glorious privilege we've been given. But oh, such a short time, such a short breath that is ours to use toward that end. Time is extremely precious because it is through this commodity that the Lord has ordained to advance His cause. And He has established how much each of us have. We can't add an extra minute to what we've been given. And every minute that we've been given is to be invested so that it produces increase for the Lord. As God gave talents, and He gave us that story about the talents that He gave out to those people and told them, go, use these, make more. He's given us time, and we need to use that time and invest it in the same way. Be productive, be effective, so that when I come back or I call you and you come home to me, I've seen this increase. This time has been well invested, and there's a great increase that has come forth. It is wonder this time, because we want to serve our own pleasures, is to be greatly deceived. Godliness is inseparable from being effective in the kingdom. And being effective is inseparable from a correct view and use of time. Don't be deceived by the romantic view of time. I challenge you to invest it through effective, selfless service. Always looking to the Lord and saying, Lord, how? How can I be effective? And that helps us discern the issues, discern the many distractions that come across our path. They're going to come across our path for the rest of our lives, the distractions, and they're only going to increase. I believe the distractions that are available in this day are greatly multiplied to when I was growing up. I feel I was much more sheltered from. I mean, you can waste time in just by sitting on the floor doing nothing, but there are so many more attractive things that come across your path that can get you distracted from using time. So I challenge you to be aware of that. Be thinking self-consciously about all that you do and saying, okay, how is this using my time effectively for the advancing of the kingdom? So it's a great challenge. I know we all fail in that in many ways, but that's what we call to. And when you understand that in the light of what God is doing, how He's bringing about His purposes and accomplishing it, we realize the significant part we have to play. As we have time, He's given us this precious commodity, and may we use it for His glory. Are there any questions or comments?
You've got Solomon. And this is the end of the matter. So He's reflecting on all these things. This is the end of the matter. All has been heard. Fear God and keep His commandments.
Right, the whole duty of man is summed up in Ecclesiastes 12:13. Fear God and keep His commandments. And it's not just an arbitrary reason to keep His commandments. It's because this is the way God's ultimate plan in history is realized. This is what it looks like. It's very dusty. It's very down to earth. And we constantly want to lift it up into a pietistic, spiritual realm that is not connected to what we're doing now, right now. Well, why don't we spend some time in prayer?